It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Director Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon, was released in theaters last month. The movie is based on the book of the same name by David Gran, which tells the true story of a string of murders of Osage people in the 1920s. Here's a clip from the movie featuring Leonardo DiCaprio as Ernest Burkhart and Lily Gladstone as Molly Kyle, an Osage woman who would later marry Burkhart.
He told me he was going with Matt Williams for a time.
You talk too much.
No, I don't talk too much. Just thinking who I got to beat in this horse race, that's all.
I didn't realize this was a race. I don't care for watching horses.
Well, I'm a different kind of horse. What was that?
Shomikasi. That's how you are.
I don't know what she said, but it must have been Indian for handsome devil.
The film has been met with mixed reviews. Some people praising its commitment to historical accuracy and inclusion of Osage perspectives. Others questioning whether a white filmmaker is the best person to tell this story. Our next guest says there should be more support for Indigenous people to tell their own stories in film and on TV. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen Killers of the Flower Moon? What did you think of it? Do you have thoughts on who should tell stories about Indigenous people in film, video, TV? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jason Aesnap is a Comanche and Muscogee writer and filmmaker based in Albuquerque, New Mexico. He's an award-winning Indigenous film critic, receiving top awards from the Indigenous Journalists Association in 2020 and 2022. Jason, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Jason, you have seen Killers of the Flower Moon. First of all, what was your take coming out of this this long movie?
It's long. It's very long. It's long. I love Scorsese, don't get me wrong. I love Scorsese. I love Mean Streets. I love Raging Bull. I love his, I just love him as a filmmaker. I think he was put in a position, and he probably put himself in the position as well, to where it's a hard position to be in. You're a non-Indigenous director trying to tell the story of the Osage people, in a very particular, delicate, story. And I think he did the best he could, but I think the story probably would have been served better by not only an Indigenous director, but an Indigenous screenwriter, maybe even Indigenous source material.
Remind us of what this story is about for people who haven't read the book or seen the movie.
Oh, it's the story of the Osage murders in the 20s, how white people discovered there was oil-rich lands, not white. Some white people discovered there was oil-rich lands and decided to take advantage of that. And then a lot of Osage people were murdered in the process for their head rights.
Now, you wrote a piece for Vox. You interviewed Osage citizens about their experience in the community while it was being filmed, working on the film. What kind of things did you hear from them?
I was a little, probably the takeaway for me that I didn't expect was just kind of how power, there was three women that I interviewed in that story, and they were still dealing with the ramifications of that, of the actual, the murders. And Osage, what I found was the Osage people really hadn't actually had a chance to kind of come to a consensus on how to discuss this amongst their own people. And so in the discussions I had with these three citizens, these three women, they were still feeling a lot of the pain of or they were processing it, of this story that had happened, in the 20s.
Now, with the film, as it tells this story, as Martin Scorsese tells the story, what, as you watched it, did you watch and say, okay, this might have been done differently and maybe done better by Indigenous filmmakers?
Yeah, I was sitting there in the theater with great anticipation, just like everyone else. But at the same time, I look, when I watch films, I kind of watch, I put several different hats on. Like there's like, obviously just thinking about just story itself without regard to like how an indigenous filmmaker would do this differently. And then I think about how an indigenous filmmaker would do this differently. And it's just kind of, I asked actually the Osage citizens that I interviewed how, if they could envision that. And it's just such a hard thing to envision because of the scope of this project was so huge, and the money, and like Native people don't get that kind of access, you know. It's kind of this kind of breakthrough that we've had with Reservation Dogs and these other shows like Dark Winds, and it's fairly recent. And so to be able to have access to something like that, the project that Scorsese did, it seems unfathomable, at least to the people I was interviewing. But I was definitely thinking how, not even necessarily an indigenous filmmaker, but an Osage filmmaker, how would they approach this story? You know, I still am curious what that might look like, you know?
It struck me reading your piece again in Vox, you and definitely the people you talk to, there's some ambivalence, glad that you know, this story was being told, that it was reaching a wider audience. But a sense, you wrote something to the effect of that the Osage people, as presented in the movie, were kind of plot points to tell us about the character development and the story progression of DiCaprio.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the respect was paid in telling the story. And like I said, Scorsese definitely did his homework and re-centered the story on Osage people and, you know, incorporated as much as he could of, you know, of their story and who they were as people, and tried to center as much as he could on the Osage people. But in the end, he's not Osage, and he can only center them so much because he doesn't understand what this story is to those people. And the ending in particular, I thought, not to, you know, give spoilers away or anything, but I thought the ending kind of also centered the story on, you know, a white perspective, like, look, in the end, this is a story of a white person telling a story about Osage people. And I think that's what he's trying to say at the end. It kind of took me a while to kind of try to understand what he was talking about. But again, it kind of like reiterates the fact that this is not a story for Osage people, and it's not from really the Osage perspective or even an indigenous perspective.
Talking to Jason A. Snap, a filmmaker, indigenous film critic. Starting point, the movie Killers of the Flower Moon, but wider issues of how Native Americans, how indigenous people are represented in movies and TV, and why money doesn't go to indigenous people to make movies and TV in the first place. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions. You mentioned a TV series that, if I'm reading you right, you think gets it a lot better. I want to give a listen to a clip from Reservation Dogs. Here it is.
Look at you. I'm grown up, got a job.
I don't even know what I'm doing, and I almost fell off the roof. It's like they don't even teach you anything. Just expect you to know.
That's the native way of teaching. We have this traditional pedagogy of just get out there and learn. I remember one time in the blizzard, I had to put up a teepee. I lost 7 children in that storm. And then come the springtime, marauders came and stole me and sold me off to slave traders. And I had to push a log around for years on end, and I became really buff and ended up in the gladiator pit.
I get it. You've had it harder than me.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say I had it harder than you. But truth be told, I had it harder than you.
Wait, that sounded like the background of Conan the Barbarian there. But Jason, talk a little bit about Reservation Dogs.
Well, I mean, there's so many things going on just in that scene. You know, there's the contemporary portrayal. There's humor. There's, some lighthearted banter. There's not overly serious discussion. It's just telling, you know, it's from a perspective of indigenous people without all the romanticism, and it's non-filtered. It's coming from a indigenous showrunner, indigenous writers, indigenous actors, indigenous, you know, directors. Like that, that's authenticity to me. And you can tell it comes through in all of that. In the piece I wrote, it's like, it seems like when non-indigenous people, when they want to tell our stories, they're so focused on like tragedy. I don't know what it is about our trauma that they seem so, you know, attracted to and wanting to, you know, to tell that story like over and over again. And it's just like, you know, I understand that that's, you know, obviously the Osage story, that Osage story is very important, but there's like, but this is a common theme with non-Indigenous people. They seem very attracted to that stuff in particular, as opposed to, you know, who we are in the here and now, you know?
And you wrote back in 2021 in Esquire, I think, you were at least hoping that Reservation Dogs would kick off a new era of Indigenous storytelling. Do you see any signs that that's happening now?
Oh, I think that's still happening. I was thinking about this project that, you know, Killers of the Flower Moon, it started before the pandemic, and it's kind of a carryover from, you know, probably, you know, 2019, 2018. I think one of the people I interviewed said she'd been working on it 7 years, and I'm not, you know, it's, you know, it's a project that goes back a long ways. So, and I know that there's several, you know, things coming out that are, you know, there's a lot of things that are coming out, like, from people that were on Reservation Dogs that we haven't seen yet. And so, I think, yeah, I have, hopes for the future.
Talking to Jason Aisnap, Comanche and Muscogee writer, filmmaker, and film critic based in Albuquerque. We're talking about how Indigenous people are represented in film and TV when they make the movies and TV themselves as well. After Martin Scorsese's new movie, Killers of the Flower Moon, made a splash in theaters earlier this month, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have favorite movies and TV shows that represent Indigenous people? Do you notice changes happening in the kinds of stories that are being told in popular releases? Are you a fan of Reservation Dogs? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation. Maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now we're picking up our conversation with Comanche and Muscogee writer, filmmaker, and critic Jason Aisnap about who gets to tell Native American history in movies and TV in particular. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have any recommendations of Indigenous TV shows or movies you've enjoyed recently? Are you looking for recommendations from our guests? Do you have questions about what it's like for Indigenous filmmakers behind the scenes? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Matega is with us in Milwaukee. Matega, hi.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Okay, so I'm Native American, and I'm a Little Traverse Odawa in Saginaw, Chippewa, and I saw the movie Killers of the Flower Moon, and although, you know, I'm not Osage, I was very proud of it, you know, still, even if it wasn't done by Indigenous makers, but, you know, I did appreciate them using the location and some Indigenous actors. But I did have a question, and I was wondering, so I think when Dances with Wolves came out, you know, how that was very mainstream, and they thought that that would be bring, you know, Indigenous people or Natives into the spotlight more to films, and then that idea kind of seemed to fade away. So I'm wondering, is it going to be like that with Killers of the Flower Moon, or is it, you know, are Indigenous going to have more of a standing in mainstream films?
Matega, thanks for the call. Jason, what do you think?
Oh, yeah, I think we have a stronger standing these days with people like Taika Waititi and Sterling Harjo, who are actively, like, you know, making projects. And they seem to have, like, you know, a big footprint now. Like, they've gotten some traction. I think that things are different now than they were back in, you know, what was that, 1990? I can't even remember when Dances with Wolves came out. But we have, like, people that are, you know, that are in place now that are, you know, Sterling's, you know, he's producing, I know he wrote Res Ball, I think it's coming out with Sydney Freeland, who's a Navajo director, and that's going to be coming out probably next year. And then there's the Echo, you know, Marvel series that's coming out. I mean, there are things that are coming out that are, we haven't seen yet. And I think that we're in a much better position as Indigenous people for our media than we were like 20 some odd years ago, I think.
Matega, thanks a lot for the call at 800-642-1234. Mike joins us now in Brookfield. Mike, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just kind of wanted to ask your guest, do you think there's an issue or a problem with, you know, taking issue with how a film or a story is being put together, especially in something that's a really very large collaborative project, where there's a non-Indigenous, in this case, person that's making the story, and saying that there's somehow something maybe special that an indigenous director or screenwriter might bring that a non-indigenous person making that same collaborative effort might bring. And then the other piece that I kind of thought of while I was waiting was, how does your guest perceive this story as solely an indigenous people's story when it's a story that's taking place in the panoply of what's going on as the American continent or the North American continent is being settled over, you know, a several hundred year period of time by millions of Europeans.
Mike, I gotcha. So to his first point, Jason, I think Mike making the case that, okay, even if it's a white film director, if it's a collaborative process, if different voices are involved, does that answer some of your concerns?
You know, it's rare that I've seen it done to my satisfaction, at least over the, you know, in recent memory. I will say that, like, Prey, which was produced by Comanche producer Gene Myers, and then it was written and directed by, I think it's Dan Trachtenberg. I forget. He's a, you know, non-Indigenous guy. I thought that was done very well. That actually, I thought that kind of, like, broke my own role as far as my own rule for, like, what I think an Indigenous film is, because to me, my own personal role is like it needs to be either an indigenous writer or director. But Jane figured out how to, you know, as a producer, create some sort of Comanche footprint on that film by actually having a dub in the Comanche language, which is the first film, as far as I know, like first feature length film done that way. And it was incredible to see it. I thought it was just, yeah, I was so. I thought that was a really cool film, cool sci-fi film.
And to Mike's, go ahead.
Yeah,
Jason.
What was the second question?
The second point was there are white perspectives on the story, Native perspectives on the story, and if I'm hearing you right, Jason, you'd like to see more opportunities for that Indigenous story to be so foregrounded in movies and TV.
Well, I think that really at the end of the day, this is an Osage story. This is, even though you could approach it as like a Western or like, you know. You know, look at it like a big wider lens. It, to me, it's an Osage film, and it's an Indigenous film. So, that's how I would answer that question. You could, one can look at it different ways, but to me, when I see Killers of the Flower Moon, this is an Osage movie.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Talking to Jason Aesnap, a filmmaker, Indigenous film critic as well. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. In that recent piece in Vox you wrote, Jason, it seems like one big structural problem is Native filmmakers, directors, and writers aren't getting the money to do these kind of things. What kind of changes would you like to see to provide more opportunity for these stories to be told from an Indigenous perspective?
I think that probably is changing a little bit towards the better, but yeah, just funding, like more funding for to make projects bigger. You know, we have like Sterling is doing some cool projects. Like Reservation Dogs has been a big breakthrough for Indigenous media, cinema, television. A lot of those folks I've heard have gotten a lot of opportunities, who were on that project have gotten a lot of opportunities from that project that we probably haven't seen, you know, or you know, that'll come in the future. But yeah, it would just be, you know, it would be really cool to have like some actual big like Hollywood funding behind, you know, an actual Indigenous narrative that's written and directed by us. That would be great, you know, just to have that kind of actual funding rather than, you know, I apply for grants and stuff and I get small funding here and there. And I'm always appreciative to make, you know, my next, whatever project comes next. Like, but yeah, it would be nice to have more doors open for Indigenous writers and filmmakers to make our own stories. And I think we tell our own stories the best. I don't think we need a filter.
I want to drop a couple names that you've mentioned and things you've written about. Rutherford Falls, a short-lived show set in the eastern United States with some Native American perspective and participation. Your thoughts on Rutherford Falls?
Yeah, it was a cool project. I noticed that a lot of the people from Reservation Dogs and Rutherford Falls, they went back and forth and they worked on both projects. So it's always good to see you know, a project, a native project come to fruition and be seen by people, you know, on the screen. I'm always supportive of that, you know.
And there was an episode, I think, of Rutherford Falls that made fun of almost directly another show, Yellowstone, not made by an Indigenous creator, often portraying Indigenous people, though. Very, very popular show with spinoffs. Taylor Sheridan, the creator of these shows. Your thoughts on that and how it fits into the world of portrayal of Indigenous people on TV?
Yeah, Taylor Sheridan makes a lot of Westerns and a lot of Westerns about that include my own Comanche people. The Comanche tribe. You know, it's interesting. I mean, I think sometimes when I watch, you know, his work, I feel like I feel that he's not connected to the stories that he's talking about. I'm thinking in particular of like, there's a boarding school storyline, and I forget what the name of the show is, 1923 or something. And it really was kind of difficult to watch because it's like, he's talking about something that he's not really a part of. And sometimes it comes off exploitive. It became kind of difficult for me to watch. And to me, I think an Indigenous writer or director would handle those stories with more nuance and care. And I would rather see that.
And just in our last half a minute, Jason, as a filmmaker, if you got the funding to make, you know, a decent sized Hollywood movie, what is a story you'd want to tell on screen? Just in our last half a minute.
I'd want to tell the story about my own, you know, Comanche people and my own great, great grandfather, Quanah Parker. And he was a very wild, interesting, person. And he was one of the last leaders of my tribe. And I know a lot of people have been trying to tell that story, but I would love to tell that story. I would love to get the funding to do something like that. And I have people, friends, collaborators that also want to help me tell that story. So that's the one.
Jason, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, thank you.
Jason Aznap is a Comanche and Muscogee writer, filmmaker, and award-winning film critic based in Albuquerque, New Mexico. He's with us today to talk about Indigenous representation on screen, why he believes Indigenous writers and directors should get more funding, more support to tell their own stories. I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. At least 17 workers have died on Wisconsin dairy farms in the last 15 years. Most of them have been immigrants. Reporting from ProPublica found that the Occupational Safety and Health Administration did not investigate many of those deaths. That's because of an exemption that limits OSHA's authority to inspect and enforce safety laws on some smaller farms. The reporting found that OSHA might have been able to do more in those instances to protect workers and reduce the risk of great bodily harm or death. It all raises questions about workplace safety in a vital Wisconsin industry. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you heard about these Wisconsin dairy farm worker deaths in recent years? Has one of those happened in your community? What kind of things should be done to protect dairy farm workers? What questions do you have about this issue? If you work in or around the dairy farm industry, love to hear your perspective on safety at the workplace. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Mariam Jamil is an engagement reporter for ProPublica. She's the co-author of several stories from ProPublica on issues facing immigrant dairy farm workers in Wisconsin and elsewhere. Mariam, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You've covered a lot of workplace safety issues around the country. What drew you toward this story of immigrant dairy farm workers here in Wisconsin?
Right. Well, Wisconsin is very notable for a couple of things. So not only is it one of the nation's top producing dairy states after California, we also noticed from afar, my colleague Melissa Sanchez and I, who have been doing all these stories together, when Melissa first started, you know, pitching our bosses on taking a deep dive. Now we've been doing this for more than a year, just focused on Wisconsin's dairy industry. When she first pitched our bosses, it was partially because Wisconsin dairy workers are dying at a higher rate than dairy workers in other states. And there are protections that workers in some of the other dairy states have that Wisconsin workers notably don't have. For instance, there's no state occupational safety office that is looking out for workers. So the state is dependent on federal OSHA. So basically some of the protections there are thinner than they are, for example, in California. We had noticed just terrible incidents happening to dairy workers from afar. And so we figured there's probably a lot more to see here. Deaths are usually the more trackable, provable, documented bad things that happen to workers. And we knew there are probably many, many injuries as well that were not being tracked or documented anywhere. So we figured it was worth spending attention on this group of people in this very important industry because there's so little resources and attention paid to them already.
And people might think, okay, well, if there's no state Occupational Safety and Health Administration, that's okay, because there's a federal one, and people might assume, I would assume, if there's a death at a workplace, OSHA might investigate. They have the jurisdiction to investigate. But, and this is a little complicated, when it comes to small farms, it's not always clear that they do.
Yeah, this is very true. So farms across the country are limited when it comes to occupational safety oversight by this thing called the Small Farms Exemption that you explained a couple minutes ago. So basically, since 1976, Congress has written into OSHA's budget every single year that they can't use their money to do any kind of enforcement or training, just anything really related to a farm that has 10 or fewer employees. This is something that is, I believe, reading through the congressional record and all the arguments that took place back when this was first being put into place. This is something that was intended to protect small farmers, small businesses, people who are so focused on keeping a business running and don't have their legal department, their HR department, et cetera, to help them just kind of focus on running a farm and not face the risk of fines and what's looked at as government overreach. But we see that you have the deaths occurring at a significant rate on these farms. And sometimes when we've been talking to workers on these farms, the safety lapses are notable.
Can you tell us about the kind of stories you discovered when it came to these immigrant workers and the tragic incidents that they died in?
Yeah, so we've been collecting these case files for a long time now, and it was really nice to spend the time with them and kind of investigate what happened, look through all the documentation. So as recently as this March 2023, on a small farm in a town called Melrose in western Wisconsin, there was a worker who was driving a skid steer, which is kind of like a very small tractor. It's used in most agricultural settings, dairy farms, it's used in construction. They can cause a lot of injuries. He was driving a skid steer to clean up manure and drive it into what's called like a manure lagoon or a manure pond. Cows produce a lot of it. And so there's often somebody who is, you know, every day driving this vehicle to scrape up manure. Not every dairy farm has a manure pond, but when they do have one, it's something that's really hard to get out of if you go in. So this man, his name was Florencio Gomez Rodriguez. He was on his shift. It was his 30th day at a new job. It was nighttime, around 9 or 10 p.m. And nobody had seen him for a while. And so his colleagues began to kind of look around. They didn't see the vehicle he was supposed to be driving, the skid steer. And then they see a little bit poking out of this manure lagoon, which kind of looks like a big swimming pool of mud. And so, yeah, they realize that he's likely in there. They call the law enforcement and then they pull this vehicle out. He's in there and he has drowned inside this manure lagoon. This is something that also a very similar thing occurred to one of the other workers whose deaths we looked into. These types of lagoons are usually supposed to be fenced off. They're supposed to have something that can keep a vehicle out of it, a person out of it, a cow out of it. But a lot of the time they're not fenced and there isn't a lot of oversight of, you know, whether or not they're keeping up with safety requirements. And it's something I think from what I've heard talking to farmers, talking to different people about the reality of operating these machines, of being in charge of a manure lagoon, it's hard sometimes, I think, for them to like keep up with the fencing because they have to take it off to agitate the manure. They have to do all these things, but it's a very real risk and has led to deaths around the country, this particular hazard. At some of the other workers that whose deaths we looked into, they had been crushed by skid steers or telehandlers, so different types of farming vehicles that are very heavy, that have parts that can fall on you if something's not quite right with the machine. So they were crushed by the heavy metal arms of the machines that they were cleaning. Other deaths that we looked into happened when workers were moving cows back and forth between different parts of the farm that they had to be on. So dairy cows often weigh around 1,400 pounds. And so if as a human, you're crushed by a dairy cow, that can be fatal or very damaging. And so some of those deaths happened because workers were crushed or trampled by cows.
We're talking to ProPublica reporter Mariam Jamil about her reporting on issues facing immigrants working on dairy farms in Wisconsin and gaps in OSHA oversight. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What kind of protections would you like to see for dairy farm workers? Would you like to see stronger state standards like California has that might close some of those gaps in the federal workplace enforcement? Do you or a loved one work in the dairy farm industry? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Mariam Jamil, engagement reporter for ProPublica, with us today to share her reporting on immigrant dairy farm workers in Wisconsin, the serious risks they face. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls. Don is with us in Ixonia. Don, hi.
Hello. How are you doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Don?
Well, I guess from my distinction, I grew up on a small dairy farm and did lose my brother to a farming accident, and had a lot of people who said to my father, you know, why don't you sue? Well, he was a friend of my father, and the whole look was there is like my father said, you know, suing my friend, you know, how is that going to bring back my son in any way? And all it will do is ruin and bankrupt him. So, you know, I guess in my distinction of looking at farms, I guess there should be OSHA should be looking into, I guess, farm accidents, I think. But I think there has to be a different distinction of a small family farm versus the large corporate farm who's employing a lot of people.
Don, thanks for sharing your story. So sorry for that loss in your family. Mariam, OSHA regulations do kind of do what Don was talking about there, make a distinction for smaller family farms. But I read in your reporting, what we think of that family farm may have changed a lot over the years, where instead of it's, you know, my family and maybe a couple neighbors from time to time, there are long-term staffers or coming in and out immigrant farm workers, often undocumented, on a lot of these slightly larger dairy farms.
Right. Don, thank you so much for your call, and I'm so sorry to hear of your loss. There are a couple of things coming to mind about the way that OSHA does distinguish between small and large farms. So I believe that on smaller farms, basically on a smaller employer, when OSHA goes and does an inspection and finds failures in safety that they identifies failures in safety that they want to issue fines for, those fines will be limited based on the size of a farm, or the size of any business. So basically, they're going to suffer less financially just because they are a smaller business. And another thing is that when it's speaking of family farms, the people who are, let's say, an owner, like a child of an owner, a husband or a wife, an immediate family member, basically, that's a part of the farm, OSHA does not count those as employees. That might get a little tricky once we go into like a cousin, an uncle, someone who is paid, who's also technically family. OSHA does tend to count those as employees, but that is a really important distinction to make. The family farms that are truly family farms, not employing outside people, are regarded differently by OSHA. And you mentioned the immigrant workers, I think, yeah, that is something that has changed in Wisconsin, whereas once these farms were were being worked by immediate family members and by local folks. Now there are primarily undocumented immigrants from Latin America who are the employees on these sort of medium and larger farms. And these are people who are disadvantaged in different ways. Sometimes they might not have had the level of training or training in their language. These are folks who don't have immigration status, a work visa, something that gives them the flexibility to just go to another job, to speak up if they don't feel like the conditions are adequate, things like that. And I think that is what has made a lot of people look at the oversight and safety on these farms that are employing immigrant workers differently than maybe they would have liked to for the very small family farm.
Thanks again for calling in, Don. Julie is with us in Madison now. Julie, hello.
Hi. How are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Julie?
Well, I'm about 60 years old, and I grew up on a farm in Wisconsin, a small dairy farm. And my father died in a farm accident. I'm not bitter or angry. He was a person who was knew what he was doing and was stubborn. It made it tough, though. He climbed up a silo when he had lost some strength in his hands and fell to a death. And as I grew up, I ended up becoming a police officer, and I have this conflict with this conversation. It feels like insurance and capitalism should not drive safety. Safety should be for all of us. And whether, I mean, it's a family farm or not, I understand things are driven by litigation, but frankly, we need to protect everybody a little bit more on the prevention end and education end. And if there's language barriers, that's just even worse, because no amount of money fixes these things. I guess I felt like OSHA and other agencies should be about as much prevention as possible.
Julie, thanks a lot for the call and for sharing your story. I don't have a lot of time left. Mariam, can you talk a little bit about, do you see efforts out there to do some of the things Julie is talking about? Better lessons in prevention, safety, overcoming language barriers that we were talking about earlier in ways that might make people proactively safer rather than investigating afterward.
Right. That's a really great point, Julie. And I'm also sorry to hear of your loss. You see in Wisconsin, UW-Madison Extension, different UW Extension offices doing a lot of work to educate farmers and sometimes workers on different safety issues proactively. Interestingly, to our conversation about OSHA, that small farms exemption that bans them from investigating after something bad happens or allegedly happens also bans OSHA from doing any training, which I think is very troubling to people in the occupational safety community. And there are different nonprofits locally that are focused on workers' rights. I will say from our reporting, most of those do not seem to have reached dairy workers to the extent that maybe they've reached other workers. A distinction with dairy is that people are working longer shifts than in most industries. Cows need to be milked 2 to 3 times a day. People are generally working 70 plus hours a week. They're on remote farms that they're living on. So these questions of safety and training are especially important, and they're also probably less likely to happen. So we have seen good initiatives in Wisconsin that are ongoing and people whose lives are dedicated to the safety and training. But those are sort of limited solutions that aren't truly getting at the problem, I think, to the extent that the problem exists. And it's interesting when we ask different government agencies who are relevant to the dairy industry, like the DATCAP, the Consumer Protection and Agriculture Agency, and others, about these questions relevant to dairy worker safety, they always come back to us and say, like, oh, we don't actually have anyone who works on this. So like a larger coordinated effort doesn't really seem to exist. Some dairy industry groups also have some trainings available, and insurance companies for farms also advise farms. But yeah, we're seeing that it's not enough to keep these injuries and deaths from happening.
Mariam, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for sharing your reporting with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Mariam Jamil, engagement reporter for ProPublica. She joined us to share her reporting on immigrant dairy farm worker deaths in Wisconsin. She's been working with colleagues on a long series on this issue, both here in Wisconsin and beyond. We'll get a link up to her ProPublica reporting. You can find that at WPR.org/Central Time. Again, that's WPR.org/Central Time. Five years ago, southwestern Wisconsin was hit by an unprecedented flash flood that destroyed homes, businesses, and infrastructure. Now, government officials and a grassroots community group are recommending a new way of dealing with flooding. As Hope Kerwin reports, their proposal is to decommission a system of dams built 70 years ago.
A small, unnamed creek flows through Tucker Greedebeck's farm in Monroe County. This fall, the water was only about ankle deep. But when it rains, water rushes down the steep slopes of the Driftless region into the valley. It's why, more than 60 years ago, federal officials built a flood control dam there. In August of 2018, about 12 inches of rain fell over the area in roughly 6 hours. Greedebeck says he knew immediately that everything had changed after the storm.
Looking down through the trees, all I could see was sand. I could see white, and I knew everything was gone.
Half of the valley behind the dam had filled with water, overtopping the structure and bursting through the bluff of sandstone on one side. Today, the 40-foot grass-covered dam still ends in an abrupt drop, and huge chunks of sandstone dot the land.
You know, having something this big that backed up so much water, and when it fails, it's catastrophic.
The dam on Greedebeck's farm was one of five that failed in the Coon Creek and West Fork Kickapoo watersheds during the 2018 flood. Major flooding has become more common in the region in the last 2 decades, a trend scientists say is driven by climate change. In the aftermath of any natural disaster, attention turns to rebuilding. But recovery hasn't been simple here. Officials have realized that replacing these flood control dams that were built in the early 1960s is not the most cost-effective way forward. Steve Becker is state conservation engineer for the Natural Resources Conservation Service, the federal agency that built the dams. The flood that destroyed the dam on Greedebeck's farm is what's called a full pool event, and a repeat could be dangerous.
No one wants to see that type of a sudden breach if another full pool event occurs. Those sudden damages can take people off guard and can result in, you know, loss of life.
That's one reason why the NRCS is recommending that 22 of the dams in the two watersheds be removed. Becker says that over the last 60 years, the dams have brought about 90 cents in flood control benefits for every dollar spent on construction and maintenance. But moving forward, rebuilding or reinforcing the dams would only provide around 10 cents in benefits to every dollar spent. That's mainly from increased construction costs. The NRCS will release the final draft of their Coon Creek Watershed Project Plan this month. After that, it will be up to county officials to decide how to move forward. But some residents are already working toward a future without the dams.
We know that there are structural issues, and so what we need to do is learn to live without them.
That's Nancy Wedwick, a longtime resident of the village of Coon Valley. She says local history inspired her and her neighbors to come together to form the Coon Creek Community Watershed Council. In the 1930s, the Coon Creek watershed was home to the first soil conservation project in the nation. The Civilian Conservation Corps worked with local farmers to stop the rampant erosion and flash flooding that was tearing apart the area during the Dust Bowl era. Wedwick says today, the council's goal is to raise awareness about land practices that can prevent flooding by putting more precipitation into the ground where it falls.
Here we are again now 90 years later, right? We've lost our way in some cases, and that, of course, is compounded by the, you know, change in climate and all of the weather that we are now seeing. But the important thing to remember is that we did this before.
In September, the group hosted a 90th anniversary celebration for the original Coon Creek Watershed Project to celebrate the history of their area and acknowledge the new set of challenges the region faces. Wedwick says it will take everyone in the watershed working together, but she's optimistic residents can do something to lessen the impact of floods like they did nearly a century ago. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Find out how Wisconsin's biggest cities are working to deal with homelessness, and you can share what's going on in your community. And if you work with homeless people in your part of the state, they'd love to hear your story on the morning show. You can get the conversation started right now, or if you've experienced homelessness yourself, you can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Then join the conversation tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. If you have cats in your life, you may wonder how to figure out their emotions, what they're thinking. Cats' faces may not look very expressive, but it turns out there are lots of clues in the look that a cat is giving you, even more when cats look at each other. As reported in Smithsonian Magazine, researchers collected hours and hours of video of cats interacting with each other at a cat cafe. They cataloged the different expressions that the cats made. Facial expression changes included ear position, whisker and mouth movements, blinks, 20 more elements on top. Putting it all together, they found 276 unique facial expressions, some friendly, some hostile. General trend, quote, cats tend to move their ears and whiskers toward one another during friendly interactions, away during unfriendly ones. Ultimately, they hope the study can be used to find compatible cats to live together in a household. My favorite cat expression is the one where they taste something they're not quite sure about, and they do that kind of open mouth grimace. I use that one myself sometimes. It's cat news you can use. This is Central Time.